fired up the armadillo, and steered for the gates. The sky was purple now, and the compound lights dimmed into darkness. All he could see was the line of dipped headlights behind him. He could remember when Ephira had so many streetlights that it illuminated the clouds, and he could see it from 20 clicks. Energy was plentiful. Now the city was almost in darkness, with only essential street lighting maintained, and only for a few hours a night. There was no formal curfew, but there might as well have been. Dom accelerated into the gloom and turned the corner into the main road, back to humanity's last refuge. And even on these deserted streets, he still looked out for Maria every step of the way. Center Convoy. Hoffman's calf hurt like hell. It was a great way of staying alert. Caliso kept glancing at him as the APC bounced over debris, as if he was testing him to see if hitting a really big pothole could make him scream. Maybe it was time for a shot of painkiller after all. I'm an idiot. If I'd been killed, guess who would take over? Reed or McClintock? Kiss humanity goodbye. Assholes, both of them. Hoffman didn't want to go down in history as the guy on whose watch the human species ceased to exist. The fact that there'd be no history to judge him by if that happened didn't lighten the load one bit. But he wasn't going to live forever, and the officer, Gene Poole, was looking more shallow with every passing day. Succession was starting to preoccupy him. He had to find some bright kid to polish for the future. Phoenix would have been a candidate if he hadn't been such an impulsive and surly bastard. Yeah, I see the irony in that, thanks. Maybe I don't trust him because I don't trust myself. He realized he didn't automatically think traitor now, though. Why did I do it? Hoffman had never shirked a dirty job in his life, and he'd had to do plenty. It appalled him now to think that he'd simply left Marcus Phoenix in a deserted prison and didn't even do him the basic courtesy he'd have granted a sick dog of putting a round through his head and getting it over with. In the last few nights, he'd found himself thinking through the small details of the kind of death that he already knew too well from another war, that eventually the water and food would have run out, food immediately, water maybe a few weeks later, or the locust would have broken into the cell. Did any man deserve that? Hadn't Phoenix earned a little mercy with his war record? Didn't Hoffman himself have higher standards than that? It was just a split-second's decision. Open the doors, let the bastards out. Including Phoenix, sir? No, screw him, he can rot for all I care. Just a snarl as he reached for his sidearm and went off to deal with another crisis. Pressure wasn't a reason, because Hoffman made split-second decisions every day of his life. It plagued him now that he didn't know why he'd done it, and he didn't know the man who'd done it, because it wasn't the Victor Hoffman he thought he was. Hoffman realized that when he saw Phoenix get out of the Raven, rescued from his cell by a buddy who defied orders and was willing to die for him, and he had to look Phoenix and Dom in the eye. And Phoenix was still willing to fight, even after all that shit, even after I abandoned him. He still pulled out all the stops. Hoffman wondered if it was Dom Santiago's opinion that troubled him most. You did it. Live with it. Learn from it. The road ahead was dead straight. No bends or underpasses, no blind spots. Good visibility, even in the patchy street lighting. Without the visible damage to buildings, it could have been any run-down neighborhood before E-Day. Groups of stranded leaned against walls or sat on doorsteps, smoking or drinking, savoring the novelty of being outdoors and able to relax for once. Even their raised fingers of contempt as the cog vehicles passed by seemed almost genial. It wasn't the place for an ambush. Even so, Calizo's fingers tightened on the wheel. Hoffman found himself looking from side to side at more than the unkempt rabble loitering there. He could see no combat indicators, the telltale signs of trouble coming that he'd been so thoroughly trained to look for as a young gear that the awareness was an extra everyday sense as natural as seeing or hearing. The street hadn't emptied of people. There were no vehicles parked that the convoy would have to skirt around. There was nothing tangible to blip his radar. But he still knew, felt, tasted, understood somehow that trouble was imminent. Calizo had one hand on the wheel and the other resting on his sidearm. He knew it, too. Phoenix's voice filled Hoffman's head.
APC-1 to all vehicles. We're getting vibrations up here. Stay sharp.
It might have been nothing. It might have been more aftershocks as bedrock settled after the light mass bombing. It might have been just a collapsing sewer somewhere. But the stranded were suddenly vanishing, thinning out into the buildings, and Hoffman trusted the wary human animal in all of them more than he trusted technology. But that had its place, too.
"Convoy command to control," he said. "Stroud, possible contact. We're getting shakes. Run a check for us."
"Already on it, Colonel. Jack's been route-proving ahead of the column. I've sent it to double back."
Anya was smart. She understood ambushes. She understood that they could hit anywhere along a...
"Shit!"
The shout was so loud in Hoffman's earpiece that it hurt. He couldn't tell where it had come from. No damn call sign. Civvies, no friggin' discipline. Calizo held his speed. If you weren't driving into an ambush, you kept going. If you were driving into one, you slammed on the brakes and backed out fast.
225! We're hit! We've rolled!
That number meant that the vehicle was to the rear of the command dill. A big chunk of convoy was following it.
Shit! Grubs!
Gunfire rattled, both in Hoffman's earpiece and echoing off the buildings outside, followed by multiple explosions that sounded like a boom shot. He caught sight of Jack as the bot shot past head height at high speed toward the rear of the convoy. The line of trucks was spread over at least a kilometer, spaced at 25-meter intervals, now that it was in a built-up area. He didn't know exactly where Vehicle 225 had stopped, or if there was an escape route for the tail following it. Only Jack could see that. All Hoffman could do, all any of the drivers or escorts could do, was to listen to voice traffic. They were blind. Only Jack could see the bigger picture, and, through Jack's electronic eyes, Anya Stroud.
"Stroud, what can you see?"
Her voice cut in.
"Control to 227. Go left, 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 left. All vehicles follow 227.
So 226 must have been hit as well. She'd taken over the redirection, routing the remnant of the broken convoy in a loop around the ambush. It was best guess time now. If the grubs had broken through here, they could come up anywhere. But the convoy had to keep moving to stand any chance of making it.
227, I've only got one bot airborne, so call in your position at every intersection so I can direct you. Control, this is 227, turning left onto Parkway.
The voice was a woman's, tight with fear but still controlled. Not bad for a civvy.
It's grubs. We saw them. We're all clear ahead.
The woman could have been driving into anything.
Stroud, keep Jack with the lead serial, Hoffman said.
Calizo backed up and swung the dill back down the convoy at high speed, shaving past the line of trucks to his left.
We're heading back to engage the grubs. Kazrep?
Jack's over the ambush point, sir. Both 225 and 226 are stopped and badly damaged. 226 is on fire. I can see the driver and gunner. They're still in the cab. 225, driver and gunner both dead. The vehicle's overturned on its near side.
Definitely dead.
Anya didn't pause.
You won't need to check for a pulse, no. Fragmented.
Sometimes the control observers had a worse time of it, and in close-up. But there were rules. There was keep moving and clear the kill zone, and there was engage the bastards. And Hoffman was clear he and Colizo were doing the latter. He twisted as far as he could to reach behind him to feel for the grenade launcher on the rear seat. His leg wasn't troubling him now. It was good stuff, this adrenaline. As the headlight zipped past on his left, he readied the launcher and reached forward to raise the APC's canopy. The last truck in the line passed them, and they were suddenly staring down a dark road with a flickering yellow light at the far end. A blazing truck.
"They won't be hanging around," Colizo said, "but they won't have moved far."
He brought the Dill to a halt a few meters from the wreck. There were bodies, but they couldn't retrieve them yet. A couple of dead grubs slumped in a pool of dark liquid that Hoffman thought was oil from the truck, and when he got out for a closer look, it was blood. Headlights came straight on at him, but peeled off as trucks took a left as directed. Somewhere down that road was the trail APC with Cole, Mataki, and Baird.
"Control to convoy. We've got locust drones on the surface, coming down the avenue on a heading toward Parkway," Anya said.
She must have sent Jack to hover over the crossroads at high elevation to get a wider view.
"Numbers? Looks like 30 at least. They're moving in and out of the buildings."
The drivers could hear every word. Hoffman hoped the civilian ones didn't lose their nerve and try to scatter down the side roads. They'd done pretty well so far and stayed off the radios. Baird's voice cut in.
APC-3 to Hoffman. You want us to divert and engage? If we turn left at Canal Walk, we can cut along behind them and intercept them at the rotunda.
Tunneling took time and energy the grubs didn't always seem to have, and when they were moving on the surface like that, the odds were better. But the problem with an enemy that moved under you was detection. The convoy had no radar or sonic resonator that could track grubs as they moved, so it was a gamble. And maybe it was a decoy before a full-scale assault. But Baird could often think like a grub.
"The tail of the convoy is clear, sir," Anya said.
APC-3, divert and pursue.
We should have had more APCs on this, if we had enough of the damn things. Day by day, fight by fight, the COG's technology was wearing out, breaking down, or going up in flames, and it wasn't being replaced. Hoffman climbed back into the cab.
"We'll take over as trail vehicle. Time it right and we can give them a good hosing from both sides."
"Got it, sir."
"I don't want to worry you, Colonel," Phoenix said. "But if the grubs turn right at the end of the avenue, they'll be heading for the bridge." Colizo sent the Dill racing to the end of the line of trucks and did a rapid 3-point turn in the road to loop back behind the last one. There wasn't much farther to go. Once the convoy was across the river, they were on proven granite, no fissures, and the grubs would have to cross via the bridge to attack.
"Phoenix," Hoffman said, "don't let them reach that bridge."
Sometimes a simple phrase out of nowhere could dropkick Hoffman back into another world. Don't let them reach that bridge. Bridge meant one thing to Hoffman when Dom Santiago was around. Carlos Santiago's heroic death at Aspho Fields, killed on the bridge there as he and Marcus made a desperate stand to give Hoffman the time to complete his mission. Maybe the words triggered the same memory for Phoenix. Maybe it didn't. Hoffman would have bet that it did.
"Understood, sir."
In the light from the APC's instrument panel, Colizo's face looked like violence personified, another species entirely. The metal piercings and the swirl tattoos broke up the lines of his features into an alien face. When the APC reached the turnoff before the ambush point, he slowed down to stare at the wrecked trucks. Stranded had already emerged to scavenge what they could from the truck that wasn't on fire. There were bodies still in those trucks, bodies of people who took a risk for humanity's survival and paid the price.
"We can't stop. You know the procedure and why." But if Caliso didn't, Hoffman damn well would.
Sir, permission to dismount,
Caliso muttered. They were supposed to be defending the living. They'd lose precious time.
Granted, Hoffman said.
Caliso brought the dill to a halt, grabbed the grenade launcher from Hoffman's lap, and stalked over to the trucks, gesturing to the stranded with his free hand to move clear. Hoffman slid out of the dill and stood by the open hatch, weapon ready just in case.
"Stand away from the truck!" Caliso called. "You're defiling it!"
Shit, he was on one of his flaky philosopher trips again.
"Cog property!"
Hoffman yelled, just to make sure the scumbags got the idea.
"Get away from it or we open fire, understand?"
It was the standard challenge for looters, but the stranded rarely encountered it. They stared. Some ran for it, but the others went back to trying to drag crates from the vehicles, as if an angry South Islander with a loaded RPG and a lancer slung from his shoulder was nothing much to worry about. One man, suicidal bastard, was even draining fuel from the tank.
"It's all covered in oil and shit, man," one of the other men said. "You're not going to be eating it now, are you? We're starving out here."
"It's a temporary war grave," Hoffman growled, taking aim at them. "And we're dying out here."
The stranded sprinted for cover, and Caliso fired. But he aimed at the truck. A ball of smoke and flame boiled skyward. Caliso waited and watched the fire take hold, his brow creased in concentration, then turned toward the buildings where the stranded had fled.
"I'll come back later," he called out. "Don't defile this again."
He got back in the dill. Hoffman stared at him.
"What the hell was that about, Private?"
"It's a war grave, sir, like you said."
Caliso started up the APC again and slammed his boot on the accelerator.
"Cremation is the proper thing to do. Permission to retrieve the casualties later?"
There was little to retrieve, but Hoffman understood why the thought of those parasites rummaging around next to the bodies of better men really got to Caliso. He just had a very weird way of expressing it. It stopped those stranded shits from looting the truck, though.
"Granted," Hoffman said. "Nobody gets left behind, dead or alive."
It was a pledge Hoffman had always tried to honor. In times like these, preserving decency was as important as saving lives, because if humanity survived at the cost of descending into barbarism, then there was no difference between man and locust. He'd peered over that precipice more than once. If he fell again, he'd never come back. Lead APC, approaching the river.
"I frigging hate this," Dom said.
The voice traffic between the vehicles, Hoffman and Control, formed his only picture of the convoy. It wasn't so much what was being said that rattled him as what he imagined happening in the pauses between the sit-reps and diversions. If you couldn't see, you filled in the gaps. It was like listening to a radio play with most of the lines missing, knowing the cast really would get killed if anything else went wrong.
"What did we lose back there?" Rojas asked.
"Two civilian drivers, two retired gears."
Marcus was studying a strip map balanced on his thigh.
"And a few tons of food."
245 to Control," said a driver. "I've got a problem. Transmission. It's pissing fluid. The warning lights come on."
"Shit."
Marcus didn't look up.
"That's the flatbed with the fermentation vats. Wide load."
"Can you pull off?"
Anya asked the driver.
"Negative. And if I stop, I'll block the route. I've still got a couple of tankers and the trail APC behind me."
Roads might have looked passable on maps, but there hadn't been a highway repair program outside the heart of Jacinto for years. A street could be blocked by locust activity or a building collapse at any time. Anya was relying on Jack's video feed to recon new routes.
245. There's a right turn 100 meters past College Green that'll take you back onto the main route, she said. Have you got enough room to turn?
I can buy. This rig's gonna grind to a halt at some point anyway, so I don't have a lot of options.
Marcus cut in. Anya, you could divert the other vehicles around 245, extract the crew, and recover the truck later.
If he can pull over, I can fix it,
Baird said over the radio.
The driver paused for a moment.
Okay, I want to give it a shot. They'll steal anything that isn't nailed down, and we need the truck's parts probably even more than we need the mycovats. I'll stand guard on it until we get a repair crew out if need be.
I said I can fix it,
Baird repeated.
I'm coming up on the turn.
Okay, 245. Turn right at College Green. Following vehicles, hold your course.
APC-3 changing drivers, Baird said.
Baird, what are you doing? Marcus asked.
Dismounting to assist 245.
Control, I got it, Cole said. Damon's given me the keys, but he says I got to be home by midnight.
There was no point arguing with Baird now, and he was right. If anyone could keep the truck mobile, it was him.
Baird stopping to help a guy out? Dom said.
He must have had a blow to the head or something.
I heard that, asshole.
He just wants to show what a big wrench he's got, said Cole.
Hoffman cut it short.
Keep this channel free of social chit-chat, ladies.
Dom could see the lights across Tim Gadd Bridge as a double row like a runway dead ahead. The first trucks in the convoy would soon be home and dry, and then he could double back and deal with the stragglers.
Anya, how we doing? Jack keeps losing the drones. They're moving up through the buildings.
Any indication that they're making for the bridge? Marcus asked.
Not yet.
Just drones. No Reavers, Nemesists, Berserkers, not since the lightmass detonation. Dom never allowed himself to get his hopes up too high, but it was starting to look as if the Locust had been dealt a massive and lasting blow. But they won't turn off like a tap. Stragglers. Unless they've got a new plan, and they've not been big on those for the last 14 years.
Control, we're coming up to the rotunda now, Cole said.
It had been a cultural center, two crescents of museums and art galleries, around a huge sunken amphitheater that was the setting for open-air plays and concerts in the summer when it was closed to traffic. Dom didn't do plays, but it had been a lovely place for a walk and an overpriced fancy beer in the evenings. And now it was an equally lovely place for a counter-ambush if the grubs were obliging enough to walk that way.
They gotta go this route now.
There was a grunt of expelled air, and Dom heard Bernie swear in the background. Cole was obviously taking a very bumpy shortcut.
APC-3, we're coming up to the south of you, Hoffman said. We see them. Damn!
There was a burst of fire.
And they've seen us! Race you, sir, said Cole. Mataki thinks those grubs might be edible.
Now Dom knew how Anya felt. His heart was pounding with sheer frustration at not being there to add some fire support.
This is driving me crazy. Jack's detected more drones, sir, Anya said. No sign of e-holes, but they're coming from somewhere. We should go back and help them out.
More trucks rolled by Dom's door toward the bridge as they waited, the rhythmic, slow voom, voom, voom of engines counting down to the completion of the mission.
We can't just sit here.
15 minutes and they'll all be across, Rojas said, working on average speed.
Baird called in.
I'm with the truck now,
he said, sounding breathless. He must have sprinted after it.
It's a seal that's failed. I'm going to pack it with self-curing tape, because that's all I've got, and then top it up with... Aw, shit!
Contact, 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 245, contact, grubs emerging ahead of us.
It was 245's driver,
sticking to the rules on how to report an attack, but shit did the job just fine. Dom heard grunts of effort from Baird and then bursts of fire.
"We've got grubs everywhere," said Hoffman.
"Sir, I don't think they're targeting the convoy itself," Anya said. "I think their priority is gears. It's a lure."
As soon as Anya said it, Dom knew she was right.
"I hate to disappoint," Marcus said. "Get down there, Dom."
Grubs might have looked like grunting brutes, but they were smart, and they'd pulled yet another flanker on the convoy. They knew that humans like Delta and Hoffman, would counterattack an ambush rather than run and let the enemy keep control, and that meant they could pull another ambush elsewhere. Dom sent the APC screeching back down the highway, skimming past trucks as he tried to visualize the fastest route to the Rotunda and College Green. They were both within a couple of blocks. The rest of the convoy was now on its own.
"Stay where you are," Hoffman said. "Shit, Phoenix, did you ever stick to a plan in your life?"
"Anya can alert us if we're needed elsewhere."
"Damn, where are all those bastards coming from?"
Everyone had kept their channel open, as ordered. But they were all on two-way, and so every gasp, every breath and curse was in Dom's head, and there was nothing he could do to shut it out.
"Been here before," said Marcus.
He had to be remembering the same thing as Dom, he knew it.
"And I'm not making the same mistakes again."
Chapter 12
I've never met a soldier who knew he was a hero. It's not false modesty. They simply decide to do something that they know they must do, usually for their comrades, because if they don't, those people will suffer in some way. For them, that compulsion is far stronger than any fear. The fact that we find that exceptional is a sad indictment of the human race. I'd like to live in a world of heroes. If we did, there would be no wars.
General Joylan Ivor, Commander, COG Land Forces. CNV Pomeroy, somewhere off the Austria coast, 4 hours before Operation Leveler, 16 years ago. The cabin looked like a shrine, one of those impromptu street memorials made of pictures and candles that people created when an earthquake or a flood had struck. Hoffman's cabin bulkhead was adorned with photographs not of the dead, but of the living whose time was about to run out. They were UIR weapon scientists. He tried to memorize every face. When he opened that dormitory door, he had to know he was taking down the right people. It was much easier than he thought to look these strangers in the eye. "I'm going to shoot civilians. Again." The words made it all wrong. The threat, though, made it unavoidable. Maybe not. He wouldn't know until he stood there for real. Someone rapped on the frame of the open doorway. It was Bai Tak, clutching a cup.
"You want coffee, Hoffman, sir? We brew up."
"Thanks, Sergeant."
Bai Tak handed him the cup and stared at the pictures.
"This bother you, sir?"
"Maybe."
Some of the scientists were women. Women could kill you just as stone dead as men could, and one of them was about to lead a company of gears in Op Leveler. Hoffman was courteous to ladies, but he had no illusions about their lack of sweetness and light.
"I was raised on rules, rules of engagement. Assassination, well, it never used to be part of the job."
"Ah, we do it for you, then."
Bai Tak's people were historically recent recruits into the COG Empire, and they still did things the old-fashioned way.
"Your rules are dumb."
"Rules are all that stand between us and chaos, mostly."
"Someone with a small gun aimed at you, you shoot, it's okay. Someone with a gun so big you can't hold it, but it'd kill you all anyway, you can't shoot." "That is dumb, sir."
Bai Tak had remarkable clarity, and a way of making Hoffman re-examine everything he thought he knew. The sergeant saw only threats and ways to neutralize them. Hoffman's world was dominated by regulations and chains of command, the political necessity of justifying his actions. It was probably why Pisangas were natural commandos. Their doctrine was that you did what you had to, any way you could, preferably before the other guy had time to do it to you first. There was an honest morality to it. And I'm the one who told Adam Phoenix not to be so squeamish.
You're right, Sergeant, Hoffman said. My job is to protect the cog and its citizens, not to worry about my soul.
The little Pisanga shrugged.
They happy to make satellites to kill civvies, yes? They not worry about their souls. Least you got the guts to do it yourself, sir.
Hoffman drained the cup and handed it back to him, and Bytok walked away whistling. It really did make Hoffman feel better. He went back to memorizing the faces of the key personnel that Satil had identified as being the ones with the most critical skills. These kinds of scientists couldn't be replaced for years, if ever.
Betris, Evo, Moirig. He shut his eyes and tried to recall the distinguishing features. Maybe these people had changed since the ID photos were obtained. Hoffman wasn't sure that he'd recognize himself from his cog security pass.
We stack around the door, just in case, and then I open it and challenge them.
In his mind's eye, he ran the route penciled on the ground plan on the makeshift desk in front of him, counting the seconds it would take from the time they'd breached the main doors to the moment he burst into the accommodation block. They'd rehearsed each stage of the assault. They knew as much as they were ever going to know now.
Comms. Destroy aerials and antennae.
Power. Leave generator intact to exploit security overrides and enable bots to access mainframe. Anyone we encounter, they won't be friendly forces, not at all. There were only 26 hours in a day. He didn't have the time to delve into possible gray areas, and the cog didn't have the luxury of leaving anything for the UIR to use to regenerate the program. This time tomorrow, it'll be over, or I might be dead. The ship's address system summoned the duty landing crew to receive an incoming Raven. Hoffman took little notice and carried on visualizing the mission, checking the bulkhead clock occasionally to see how much time he had left for a final briefing. But he was interrupted again by a tap on the door frame.
Sir? It was one of the signals officers. Agent Satil and Professor Phoenix have landed. Captain asks if you'd care to join them in the day cabin.
What do you mean, landed?
They're here to evaluate any material you extract, sir. The bots have to be processed immediately. We can't rely on data transmission links alone in case they're jammed.
It was the only way they'd know what they'd grabbed, of course. They had to know before they pulled all troops and vessels away from Austria. What they hadn't grabbed, they had to destroy.
Give me 5 minutes, Hoffman said.
One more thing, sir. Personal message for one of your gears. Private Santiago's family is trying to get word to him that his wife went into labor early and the baby is fine. What would you like me to do with the message?
Give it to me, said Hoffman.
He read the note and then pocketed it. Common sense said to hang on to anything distracting until after the mission. But the possibility of Santiago dying without knowing he had a daughter wasn't something Hoffman felt he could live with. So that's where I draw the line these days. Satil and Phoenix seemed to be setting up an operations base in the day cabin. Small steel cases with black handles stood stacked on the floor, and the polished table was covered in folders. Michelson said nothing, but the expression on his face said he didn't want any scratches on that table.
The weather's not on our side, Satil said. It was pretty rough flying out here. Are you willing to go ahead with the mission at this stage, Major?
The decision's been made.
It's up to the Raven crews to say if they think they have a chance of deploying the Marlins,
said Michelson. Dalyell won't ignore professional advice.
Hoffman looked at the bulkhead clock.
Well, that's a first for a goddamn politician. Sounds like he wants to offload blame. Okay, we wait until the last moment, until high tide. And if the weather hasn't improved, and they're still willing to fly, and you think the Marlins have a reasonable chance of making it in and out, then I say we go.
I agree, said Phoenix. I don't think Austria will buy a second assault on some third-rate target at a later date. They've got their own intelligence. They'll work it out sooner rather than later.
I'd launch from this ship if we had the range, but we can't trade off any more fuel against load.
Is C Company returning to Kelowna after the mission? Phoenix asked.
That's the plan.
Then I'd really like to see my son, if that's at all possible.
Hoffman felt it was all a little late, but he didn't have the time or the patience to argue it.
Not my call, he said. But I'm sure the respective COs will arrange to cross-deck him if they can.
Hoffman wondered what Professor Phoenix had to say to Marcus that couldn't wait until he returned to Ephira. It wasn't the only domestic business that couldn't wait. Hoffman remembered the folded note in his pocket and decided it was time to assemble his teams. He'd start with a quiet chat with Dom Santiago. CNV Kelowna, somewhere northeast of the CNV Pomeroy. Fleet Met had been right about the weather, but wrong about the time. The wind had picked up just after sunset. Kelowna was rolling. Carlos didn't feel sick, yet, but listening to other gears tumbling out of their bunks and rushing for the heads every so often made him worry he'd start vomiting too. As long as he didn't hear the puking, he was okay. Really, he was. He tried to work out if the motion was less noticeable if he shut his eyes or if he focused on a fixed point on the panel above his bunk. The strip of veneer was covered with traces of peeled paper, as if previous occupants had stuck pictures on it and then carefully removed them when their draft ended. There was no trace of what they'd depicted. Carlos imagined wives, sweethearts, kids, maybe even husbands, because there were some female crew. We're late. Maybe it's aborted because of the weather. He glanced at his watch. He could just about see the readout. It was just after 24:30, during what they called silent hours here, and it was anything but quiet. Most of C Company, the ones who weren't chucking up in the heads, seemed to be dozing. Steady snores rasped around him, but the ship beyond the open doorway was alive with activity. In a couple of hours, high tide, the landing craft would slip from Kelowna's bows and head for the beach just north of Asfo Point. We're late. The ship felt as if she was corkscrewing. Carlos couldn't work out if she was riding at anchor or just making way slowly in circles. He knew next to nothing about ships, apart from the stuff he'd picked up on a couple of exercises and over the last day. Then he heard the rustle of fabric as someone walked between the rows of bunks, and a hand clasped his shoulder.
"Private Santiago?"
A young rating bent down to whisper. He had a scrap of signal paper in his hand.
"Are you Carlos Santiago?"
"Yeah."
"Message from Pomeroy. You've got a new niece, Sylvia Carla."
"Oh, wow. Thanks." Carlos forgot his stomach. Poor Maria. The kid was early, and Dom was stuck far from home, like him, somewhere out on this black ocean.
"Can I get a message to Dom?"
"Who's Dom?"
"My brother, the kid's father. All I got was a signal from the CO of Palm. There's a stop on non-operational comms while we're at defense stations, so I'm amazed they sent this. I'll see what I can do."
"Thanks, buddy. If you get the chance, say... oh, I don't know, tell Dom the drinks are on me." The rating slipped away. The bunk above Carlos creaked, and Marcus leaned a long way over the side, head down.
"Well, well. Congratulations, Uncle Carlos."
Marcus gave him a friendly punch on the shoulder. He wasn't one of life's huggers and backslappers, so it was a big deal for him.
"Good start to the mission.
And your Uncle Marcus, remember?"
"Hey, Santiago."
Maybe the rest of the non-puking guys weren't asleep after all. "Your kid brother's spawned another one already?"
"Yeah, little girl."
The ribbing started, voices drifting up from all corners of the mess deck.
"Dom knows all about diapers, seeing as he's still wearing 'em. They give those commando guys too many vitamins. What you Santiago's trying to do, breed your own army?"
Dim bulkhead lights started switching on one by one. Only a few gears were left snoring now. The ship's address system came to life.
"LCT engineering party to well deck. Gears detachment to hangar deck at 2530 for briefing."
Does that mean it's all off? That was the last thing Carlos wanted. He was past the point of walking away from it happy now. He was pumped up and ready to fight, although it was the prospect of landing on the beach that made his stomach knot more than the combat.
Aw, shit!
If they got this right, they might exfil without firing a single shot.
"No."
It was Sergeant Kennan's voice. "It means we're waiting for a go. Weather's crap. Crap as in we can't launch landing craft if it stays like this. And no, I don't know how long we'll have to wait." Nobody griped, but there was a collective murmur. Carlos wasn't sure what the strategic situation was, or even if he'd understand it if he could see it, but his small corner of op leveler meant they'd be stuck here riding it out until the next window, the next slack tide at night. 26 hours.
"I don't think I've got enough puke left in me for another day, Sarge," said a hoarse voice in the gloom. "Stick a cork in it then, son," Kennan said and walked away. "Anyone else here who's puking their ring, report to sick bay for medication, because I don't want dehydrated gears falling in the drink and drowning. It makes my paperwork just too friggin' embarrassing."
It was like getting off a crowded train. Carlos waited for the press of bodies and activity in the narrow space to clear before he swung his legs over the side of the bunk and armored up. Marcus dropped down beside him.
"You ever gonna take that thing off?" Carlos asked. "I swear I saw you showering it the other day."
Marcus smoothed his hands over his do-rag, almost defensive.
"When the war's over.
Let's hope Stroud's at peak crazy tonight and decides to go for it. I want to get in there, not dick around waiting for the sun to come out."
"It won't be her decision alone," Marcus said. "But if we don't do it tonight, it's another day for the Indies to work out where we're heading. Then we're screwed."
"You reckon your dad knows all about this, then?"
"Probably."
Marcus had that slightly distant look that said he was chewing over the situation for the umpteenth time.
"It's not that important."
But Carlos could see that it was. What could old man Phoenix tell him, anyway? Whatever it was that the raid was out to grab or trash, it didn't change a thing for them.
"He saw you off," Carlos said. "That's all that matters."
The hangar deck was a very different place from the one they'd assembled on when they embarked. The gears had to find space on it now, because it was full of crew and sea ravens, sheltering below from the high winds and heavy seas.
"Are the choppers going to be available to us, ma'am?" Marcus asked Major Stroud.
Stroud stood with her helmet jammed between her knees as she pinned her hair into a pleat. "If necessary," she said. "We're just fire support tonight, remember, so we won't be needing them unless things go badly wrong. And they shouldn't."
When women gears were armored up, it was hard to tell them from the men. The chest plates obscured any curves,
and the assortment of plates, webbing, and pouches strapped onto the thighs gave women the same exaggerated walk. Some of them were taller than the guys, anyway. There weren't many women in combat roles, but to fight in the front line, they had to be fit enough to do what a man could, no concessions or exemptions. Carlos thought that was fair, and he treated any woman who could punch him out with due respect. He had no doubt that Stroud could.
"Listen up, people," she bellowed.
Her voice cut through the noise around them, making even the maintenance crews pause.
"We still don't know if this mission is on. I'm waiting for orders, but we have a narrow window, so I'm prepared to launch in extreme conditions, if Hoffman is too. If it's a go, Merritt and other ships in the task group will shell the Austrian coast at Berifus as a distraction. That gives us and the raiding party breathing space to get in and out."
"Ma'am, we're not going to be able to counter aircraft from the ground with the kit we're carrying." Stroud slipped on her helmet. She was suddenly anonymous, just another gear except for the discreet rank insignia stenciled on her chest plate and that distinctive room-filling voice.
"They're not going to trash their own aerospace facility," she said, "because unless we screw up massively, that's all they'll be aware of, the raid on Asphoak Point. They'll need to tackle that counter-assault with a little care, because it's their asset, not ours. Until we stroll off with it, that is. So once the Aspho raid is over, successful or not, we bang out. It's that simple."
Most battles usually were. Getting minced by gunfire was simple, too. Carlos gave the possibility a thought. An academic one, nothing serious, just a healthy acceptance of the odds, and fell in behind Marcus in the line waiting to step into the elevator down to the well deck. The moment the safety gate closed behind him, that was it. Op Leveler had personally begun for him. Four landing craft nestled in the well deck, waiting for the sea to be allowed in and create a miniature dock, if they ever got the go. The ship shuddered with every heavy wave, booming and clanging like a heavy tin box. Marcus settled on the slats between Carlos and Sergeant Kennan.
"You okay?"
"No, but I'll be okay when we land."
Carlos was more scared of the transit to shore than what might follow. On solid ground, you stood a chance. You could run, take cover, lay up. The ground wasn't trying to kill you. The sea, though, was a very different matter. It was an enemy in its own right, something to be defeated and survived before the real battle even began. It could neither be killed nor surrendered to. Carlos felt he had no control over it, and he never liked trusting to luck.
"You'll be fine," Marcus said. "I'll see you ashore, and I'll see you're back on the boat again." It was dumb. Carlos and Marcus had fought in a dozen engagements. It was only a boat, and if the COGN could cope, then so could any gear worth his salt.
The troop sat huddled in the landing craft. Stroud was in Bernie Mataki's, and Carlos could see her head moving as she talked to Mataki, one hand cupping her earpiece, as if she was in discussion with CIC or someone. Then her head turned. She looked up toward the safety gantry that ran near the top of the bulkhead and waved. As Carlos followed Stroud's gaze, he saw she was waving to her daughter. Anya, gripping the metal rail with one hand, gave her mother a thumbs-up sign and vanished again.
"Poor kid," Kennan said.
Carlos glanced at his watch again. It was now, or it was abort. Close to slack water when the high tide would allow them closer inshore for a few hours without the need to struggle across broad, exposed mudflats.
"It's a go," Stroud said, standing up as best she could. "It's a go, people."
The lights went out, the ramp began to drop, and the sea rushed in to flood the deck in a wall of wild noise. Bernie Mataki said something that got a laugh from the islanders in her boat, whatever it was. Carlos couldn't make out the words. The four landing craft slipped onto a bucking, angry sea in complete and terrifying darkness, heading for shore.
Carlos looked back, and the ship was in total blackness. When the craft climbed the peak of a wave, he couldn't see lights on the shore. He thought that this was what space would be like, except without the icy spray that slapped him in the face and snatched his breath away. It was going to be a relief to stand on something solid and get shot at. Marcus was facing north.
"Shit," he said. "I think it's kicked off."
Carlos craned his neck. Nothing, just unbroken sea. And then there was a sudden flash of orange light reflected in the clouds in the distance, and another. The diversionary attack on Berephus had started. He couldn't hear anything. It was like distant lightning, seen but silent. Somewhere out there.
"Go on, Dom," he said to himself.
"Yeah," said Marcus.
"Show 'em, Dom."
Sea Raven SR-4467, inbound to Austri Coast.
"This is as far as I go," said the pilot.
Dom had to press his finger hard to his ear to hear his radio at all.
"Have fun. See you back in the mess."
They were 2 kilometers from shore, the Raven's engine noise lost in the roar of the storm and running without lights. Every meter that the Hello could carry them was a meter more fuel for the exfil to take them back to Pomeroy at high speed. The pilot seemed to have a special exemption from the laws of physics. He dropped the ramp in seas that threatened to swamp the whole helicopter, but Dom refused to drown, get shot, or otherwise give up and die now.
"I got a daughter. I got a little girl now. I'm going to pick her up and hold her, and I'm not leaving Maria to bring up 2 kids alone."
"Shit, why don't we just parachute in and walk back to Tyrus?" Benjafield yelled over the roar of the wind, water, and rotors.
"Joe? Joe, you okay?"
One of the Pisangas, Cho Lee Gan, was coxswain on the other Marlin. He grinned and gave Benjafield a thumbs up. Dom wondered what it would take to scare a Pisang gear, because so far he hadn't seen anything rattle them at all. He decided that if he absolutely had to do this kind of shit, then he was doing it with the best.
"We're commandos. We can do anything. Like that crazy bastard flying this..." "Go," said the pilot, "before I tip you out."
The lead Marlin didn't so much slip out as belly flop a meter into a hole that should have been sea, but Benjafield managed to hold it and steered clear. Dom kept his head down. Huddled in the Marlin with him were Hoffman, Bytok, and 8 other Pisangas. Timiu, Morgan, and Young were in the second Raven with the rest of the Pisang troop. The 2 boats came about just as the Ravens lifted and vanished. Suddenly Dom couldn't hear them, and he couldn't see them until he dropped his NV goggles into place. The lenses smeared with salty spray immediately. But faint lights were visible on the shore.
"Asfo Point," Hoffman said. "How's our bearing, Benjafield?"
"Looks spot on, sir."
By the time they edged slowly along the channels that fed into the salt marsh, the wind seemed to have dropped. It probably hadn't. It was just getting clear of open sea that made progress easier. They beached the Marlins in an inlet, unloaded the explosives, and fired up the bots. The 3 machines, Frank, Bruce, and Joe, hovered in the darkness, alive with small, dim lights that nobody would notice. Hoffman looked like he was sinking in the soft ground under the weight of his pack. They all were. Nobody dared squat or bend over too far.
"Time to earn it, Gears," Hoffman said.
He fiddled with the radio clamped to his chest plate.
"Cleaner to long stop. We're in position."
Stroud's voice responded.
"Long stop receiving. Ready in 5. Still fanning out toward the bridge."
It was a long run from the landing point to the perimeter fence. Dom wasn't sure who they needed to keep out on this deserted coastline, but it wasn't Gears, that was for sure. Asfo Point, a sprawling collection of quick-build structures tacked onto a 2-story brick building, sat on a raft of concrete in the middle of the wet, spongy landscape. A dozen nondescript cars were parked at the rear of the facility. With its casual security and generally tatty appearance, the place could have been a weather station, and that seemed to be the idea. It certainly didn't have a label that said, "Bomb here, top secret." Intel had done pretty well so far. No surprises. Everything was where they said it would be. The steel lattice radio mast that was ASFO's outgoing link to the world stood in the lee of the building, and there was a separate aerial that looked like the TV receiver. If any security staff were watching their favorite show to while away the night, they wouldn't be alerted by a loss of signal. The gears crouched by the main pedestrian gate, a simple wire-link door to one side of the vehicle gates, with an electronic lock. Morgan slipped off with six of the Pisangas and one bot to cut through the fence at the rear of the complex. It always paid to have a back door, even if the front door was pretty well left open. Timiu gestured to one of the two remaining bots. "Frank, bypass the gate lock." The bot lined itself up with the frame and inserted its probes. One gate swung open in the wind.
"If it's all this simple," Dom said, "I'll be pretty unimpressed."
It wouldn't be, of course. Nothing he'd been involved in ever was. They ushered in the bots and latched the side gate closed again. The wind was shrieking in the wires and rattling the doors of outbuildings, providing a perfect cover for noise.
"Blue One, how's the radio mast?" Hoffman said.
"Nearly there, sir."
Morgan was breathing heavily with the effort.
"Okay, we're in."
Dom faced out from the group, goggles raised, and scoped through with his Lancer. Two small lights shone back at him. It was a cat sheltering under a dump bin, but just detecting a pair of eyes, any eyes, made his scalp prickle. Morgan's breath rasped in his earpiece. Waiting was always, always the thing Dom hated.
"We're at the power supply," Morgan said. "Locating the junction box now. Bruce, cut the juice." "There. Done, sir."
Dom almost expected to see the few lights on the site dim and fail, but bots were reliable. ASFO Point was now silenced. In this weather, anyone awake who'd noticed losing an outgoing link mid-sentence would be cursing the wind, not enemy troops. The raid had just bought extra time. The doors to the main building were set to the side at right angles to the shore. The windows of the accommodation block faced out to sea. Even scientists liked a nice view when they were stuck out here in the ass end of nowhere, Dom thought. On a sunny day, though, it might have been a pleasant place to be, at least for a short time.
"Okay," Hoffman said. "I'll sweep the accommodation with Red Troop. Santiago and Green Troop, clear a path in for the bots from the front. Morgan and Blue Troop, you go in from the back and start laying charges. Benjafield, Cho, hold here, and keep an eye out for company."
Dom didn't think for one moment that Hoffman was taking the easy job. It was the first time that Dom, that any of the commandos, were going to be shooting at people who didn't have their firepower, or any firepower at all. It needed a different state of mind. It was the kind of thing Sergeant Mataki would have been good at. Snipers saw the world differently, because they had to.
"Go!"
said Hoffman, and put a quick burst through the lock on the accommodation doors. Chapter 13. Physically, commandos aren't much different from the average citizen, except they're a lot fitter by the time we finish with them. Mentally, though, they are, or they become, another species. We train them to understand and believe that they can do anything. It's the mental attitude, the absolute confidence and overriding tenacity that makes them unique. Colonel Kimberly Anders, Commando Training Director, presenting a paper to the COG Defense Select Committee on the need to create a permanent commando force. Accommodation Block, ASFO Point, Operation Leveler, 20 minutes after landing.
"I want to find myself staring down a barrel,"
That'll be fine by me.
As Hoffman moved up the corridor with Red Troop, checking open doors, the last thing he wanted was to find someone unarmed. For once, he wanted to burst into a room and meet a hail of fire, because he knew exactly how to deal with that, a clear-cut need to shoot rather than the messy business of working out what to do with noncombatants. The rules on what that meant